This episode is brought to you by Wacol, the leading lingerie brand known for exceptional fit, quality, and comfort. Offering an assortment of styles ranging from ultimate comfort bras that feature super soft fabrics, plush straps, and all-day support, to best-selling ultimate lift bras that raise the bust line up to 1 inch. Wacol truly has something for every woman. Wearing the right bra can change your look as well as your outlook. So go ahead, experience the difference a Wacol bra can make. Shop now at wacol-america.com. That's wacol-america.com. Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I'm speaking with the brilliant woman behind the Frankie Shop, Gaëlle Gervais. If you've come across the fashion editor beloved retailer, either at their New York or Paris boutiques or online, you too have probably become a fan. For years, Gaëlle has had her finger on the pulse of how thousands of women from all over the globe want to shop, stocking her inventory with classic, elevated wardrobe staples and a finely curated selection of under-the-radar designers. At Frankie, best-selling products don't just sell out, they garner massive wait lists with folks eagerly awaiting restock emails. Just last year, she added an assortment for men, which has proven to be just as successful, contributing to a total of $40 million in sales in 2022 alone. It comes as no surprise that Frankie isn't Gaëlle's first rodeo. In fact, the store's Lower East Side flagship in Manhattan was once home to her first fashion venture, Pixie Market, where she brought a similar, expertly curated assortment of reasonably priced items to a slightly younger demographic back in 2006. But before diving into fashion at all, Gaëlle had a very different day-to-day life as a producer for ABC News. Her early career was spent in the world of broadcast journalism between New York and London, two fashion capitals that would inevitably inspire and launch Gaëlle into her path as an entrepreneur. Now, on Second Life, it's Gaëlle Gervais.
I am personally so excited that we're doing this. Like, I remember the first editor who brought me Pixie Market and was like, oh, you should check this out. This is really cool. Like, your work is so tied to the early days of starting Who What Wear for me. And it's so exciting.
It's true. I remember you guys from a long time. It's true. It's been a ride and things have changed a little. But, you know, in the end, we're still here doing as good as we can.
Still here. Pivots and changes along the way. Okay. Yes. So we want to start at the beginning on this podcast. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about what you studied in school. And much more importantly, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
The dreams of a little girl. Yeah. I always wanted to be a journalist. I don't know. I felt like this was the closest, maybe as like being powerful it was, but at the same time, not having all the responsibilities, probably. that's probably what it was. But yeah, no, I always wanted to be a journalist, hence why I studied journalism in school. I mean, at first it was political science and then it became like a journalism school. And yeah, I was typing the name of the publication I wanted to work for on a typewriter when I was little. And I on a little business card, I remember. So it started like early.
Very early, I would say. So after you finished journalism school, after you finished school in France, you moved to New York. Yes. I'm curious about what that transition was like for you, because I moved to New York after college from the West Coast, and I found it to be a great transition, but also overwhelming at times, and it's the same country. So I'm wondering what that was like for you, if you experienced any culture shock, if it was easy. What was it like?
I got a job after school in Paris, And I was dating someone at the time. I mean, I was young, but I had a boyfriend and he was moving to New York. Mm-hmm. And I think I was like, what am I doing? Am I going to just really like take the subway every morning, go on a job, stay in Paris and not live my life? I was like, this is not working. And I just decided to go with him. That's pretty much what happened. So I arrived in New York, a culture shock. I mean, it kind of was, and it kind of wasn't somehow. I'm a pretty high speed person. Like mm-hmm. I mean, I'm chill, but at the same time, I love the speed of this town. I love how fast things can get done. And this is why actually moving back was more of a culture shock than the other way around. Probably moving back to France has been a challenge, but I don't remember it being like really hard. I just remembered I started an internship at the Village Voice. God knows how I got this internship. And my English was not great at the time. So it was a bit nerve-wracking. The only thing I remember talking about challenge is that I was always trying to not look French. I was trying my best to blend in as much as possible because I didn't want to be seen as like, oh, mm-hmm. you know, that precious little French thing. Like I was really trying to be cool and just more like downtown. So in a way, the appearance and whatever I was like giving from myself, from the way I looked and I talked, and it was always to try to belong. I just always felt I was like too dressed up, too this. I was like, oh, like it's not working. And meanwhile, I was trying to investigating the trash business in New York and like the dumping in Haiti and stuff like that. It was crazy, but that was fun. It was a lot of fun.
That's an amazing adventure.
Yeah.
So the Village Voice is an iconic place to start out. I'm wondering how you transitioned from that into like your first full-time job in New York.
It took some time, you know, when you're an immigrant in New York, it's just, first of all, the visa situation is like mm-hmm. complicated. So that alone, to be honest with you, is probably also one of the reasons you want to have success in your life, because it doesn't come super easy. So you just like, you're driven, you know, you just kind of want to have a piece of that cake. So you're going to work extra hard to just make sure you can stay and that you become indispensable, which mm-hmm. was also some things I remember I used to say, whatever you do, just become indispensable. You just like make sure they need you 24/7. Okay. So I've always kind of worked that way. But yeah, the transition was basically, so I was working at the Village Voice, and because I did all this investigative journalism, I met someone at ABC News during one of those stories, and he said, oh, you should come and work for us. And all of a sudden, I was doing an internship then at ABC News, the Brian Ross unit. He had his show, he had his stories on 2020. I mean, I bet Barbara Walters, like all of a sudden, I was on Columbus Circle going with my rollerblades all the way uptown. And yeah, Brian Ross was something because it was mainly research and stuff mm-hmm. like this. So I wasn't really on the spotlight. It was still like, first of all, an internship, still not being paid. And then they were trying to hire me. But of course, as a foreigner and ABC News belong to Disney, you kind of have to prove that you're not taking the job of an American person, that you're bringing something to the table. And as a French person, really, I understand they had issues to prove that. So it was that's how I moved to London. They got me a job in London.
That is incredible.
So yeah, that's what happened. In London, I got my first job at ABC News London. So I started working for everyone in London. You just move around and stuff until you figure out where you want to work. And mm-hmm. But I still wanted to move back to New York, obviously.
So I'm curious a little bit about the skills that you are learning at this point in your career, because it's interesting, especially with journalism, whether it's investigative or otherwise, I feel like a lot of it is dependent on the relationships you have with local sources. Was that a challenge? And if not, what was the most challenging part about your work at that moment? And what did you love the most?
I guess at that moment, I mean, at the beginning, it was really the language barrier. Like I really had to catch up. And in London, I started also working for French TV at the same time. So I was doing like both. also, I mean, at a time, maybe it was a little lonely. Yes, that's for sure. But I had some friends from New York that were always coming to London. I mean, and London is a very fun city. I mean, I had really two experiences in London because I moved there twice. Basically, I did New York, London, and I never came back to Paris for 25 years. So the first time was more like figure out what you want to do. I was young. I was going out. I was like, you know, so it was more of a party time a little bit more than the second time where it was like work and trying to make ends meet, like no roommate, paying your own flat, you know, like that kind of stuff. So,
yep.
But I feel like the challenges is, yeah, that was maybe mostly the language. In terms of sources, you build them as you go. It's just like a first job experience, you know, it's the same thing for everyone. It's true that I was a little bit fearless, and still today, I don't think about the problems. I just go. And then I realize, oh, well, yeah, didn't think about that. But then you deal with them as they go along, you know. I feel like fear can really be a huge like barrier for anything you want to achieve. And I know that being fearless is not always easy and not always an option, but you can do anything, really. Like if you believe in yourself and if you work hard as well, I think you can really achieve results. I've always believed that.
So at what point did you start thinking about fashion as more than a personal interest part of your day-to-day and start thinking about it as a potential career?
I think secretly my dream job would have been to be a fashion journalist somehow. Mm. I've been reading fashion magazines. I mean, I have tons at my parents' house. I have like from the 90s, and I tell my mom, if you throw them away, you're not going to see me anymore. And I just remember this. I used to sketch a lot, but I wasn't sure I was really good at it or whatever. That's why I did journalism. I was like, you know, I'm just going to do that on the safe side. At least I'll know I have some money. Mm-hmm. And then on the side, I'll just have this fashion passion, like, and we'll see if I can translate that into a career path, I guess. And this is why also I always had that in mind, the way I look, the way I carry myself, the way I present myself. It's always been a big part of my decision making somehow. And yeah, obviously, I mean, I was a shopper, but I also was very aware of what's going on. I was passionate. And the first thing I was trying to do when I finally had a bit more power at ABC News, I was like, we should do a story in Paris Fashion Week. No, right? We should just film backstage and stuff. And I pitched it and I got it. Guess what? We did it for Good Morning America. The thing is, we did it my way for Good Morning America, which was more the investigative way. You're ABC News. You arrive in those big fashion shows. And of course, they're like, okay, you know, everything is completely planned. You can only do this, 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 this. This is your slot for the interview, blah, blah, blah. And me, I did also some with Mike on camera. So I went to another show, John Galliano to say, and I went and I started filming. I filmed Lenny Kravitz. I was backstage and stuff. And I used some of this footage. So they were not happy. Because I got John Galliano's after during the proper interview, sit down with a flower behind, you know, the whole like formalized thing. And I got him like in the heat of the moment saying, oh, all this fashion drama. I forgot what he said. He was like crazy. And I was like, that's in the can. Yep. And we used it because to me, that was the real thing. Like people don't realize like fashion is all glam and stuff, but it's actually, it's hard work. This is, and there's so many people working behind it. It's, so I think we needed to make it a bit more newsy than just like the fancy stuff. So yeah, I guess you can say that I've always had this in the back of my head somehow.
Which makes sense. I feel like that's always the case with people in fashion. It's just this long simmering thing that comes out in different ways, but not necessarily in the fullest expression until a little bit later.
Yeah.
So let's talk about 2006, because that was a year of massive change for you. Tell me a little bit about what was going on in your life. Where in the world were you located at this moment?
Well, I had just transferred again in London. Basically, I kept having visa problems. So, you know, back and forth, back and forth. So I did get 3 years and three, you know, it's 3 years for a visa in America. So you get 3 years and then, oh, they have to renew it. And they forgot how they did it 3 years before. So they're like, okay, you're going to go to London just until we figure it out. But at that time, I was in a serious relationship and stuff. So I was like, listen, this is crazy. And after 6 months, I think I was in London. I was like, you know what? I started obviously thinking about like, is this really the life I want? Like, do I love my job in America or do I love it more? Because in a way, I loved my journalism work in London more than I did in New York.
Why?
Because I was dealing with foreign news in London. So the range of stories was just unbelievably great. It was the royal family, the Olympic Games in Italy. And then the next time is a face transplant in the north of France. And then I did an interview with Johnny Depp too. I was like, yeah. Like, so in America, everything, obviously, if you were in Washington, you work on political news. If you're in New York, you work on like local news. It was not as like sexy, I guess, for the lack of better word, than when I was living in London. But I didn't want to live in London. I wanted to come back to New York. That's where my life was. I had my apartment, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I met this friend who became my partner for that business that I started. And I met her in a store and we had met in New York and we're like, oh, we know each other. And then she was making shoes for the market in London at Spitalfield and Portobello. Mm-hmm. And I always used to go to those markets. Those markets back in the days in London were just like the source for so many great designers. You know, London is famous. Obviously, you have Central St. Martin's School, which has all these like youth and energy and no fear. And they just make things in their house and they sell it on the market. You go there at 5 a.m. I was like, whoa, okay. And she was doing that. And I was like, I was really interested. And I thought, I don't know, we got on really well, little by little. We're like, why don't we just do something? Like, we were on the same page, really, in terms of style and what we liked. And so we decided to go to India. Just like that. This should be my podcast title. And just like that.
And just like that. I know. Because I was going to say, like, it seems like you make some of these big decisions pretty quickly, which I love. Yeah. But I'm curious about, you're like, okay, we should go to India. How fast did that decision happen? And like, what did you tell work? Explain the backside to me.
I mean, yeah, I was still working at the beginning when I went to India, I think. I probably went on vacation, but obviously as a journalist, there's no stopping as well. You know, vacation, you still have stories that are ongoing and you're still working. But to me, it was a side thing, the India thing at the beginning. I wanted to try it and see. We had a friend who was making bags there, so we had already kind of an introduction. And we arrived there, we looked for a factory, we're using her contacts, and then that's how it happened. I went to meet this really nice man in New Delhi, I believe that's where it was. I mean, we had a little bit of a funding, and not a funding, we had a little bit of money, but not so much. We just made 3 shirts. And then, you know, obviously we came back, and when the production arrived, I was like, what the hell do we do with that?
It's like, okay, so let me make sure I got this right. So you're still working full time. You have a friend who is in like the design world, and you decide to go to India and have products made like to sell?
Yep. Where? We didn't know, but we just wanted to give it a shot, and okay. We did it. And obviously, we knew where, like, we would sell it eventually at the market and everything. But we also started to talk about a store at the time because we loved the markets. And we were like, you know, there's nothing like this in New York.
Right.
Like, I think we could become a hub for those small designers that it's not about, like, spending $3,000 on a Chanel bag. It's about, like, having pleasure, like, styling things the way you want and just grabbing a few pieces here and there that are just not too expensive. Like, really, the price tag was really important for us because this is where we felt we could make a difference because we had access to all these small designers, really, and interesting as well, not just, like, small, okay, but what they were making was really fun and cool. So we just decided to make that move in New York. I quit my job, yeah, because just like that. And I had put some money aside as well. I think we started Pixie Market in 2006. And yeah, it just happened. I mean, we cleaned the lamp with like 3 friends. We were like doing everything ourselves. There was a former hair salon, so there was hair everywhere. We were like cleaning crazy, trying to pull the hair. Let's put it this way. When you start a new business and you don't have so much money, you need good friends, okay? So that can come and help you just for these little details that somehow you're so tired that you don't even like want to think about it. So yeah, we opened and then that was it. It was a small store in the Lower East Side and it was a sublet. So it was like, oh God, these two foreigners are starting a store, you know, like for a landlord, it's like, yeah, whatever, next. So we did a sublease at first.
Also, I would say like to have a commercial lease is often for like 5 years or 10 years and you have to have guarantees against it. So it's very prohibitive if you're a new business just launching because you don't know. So a sublet makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
So the concept from the beginning was, okay, we're going to make our own version of like Portobello in the sense of up and coming designers, new designers, interesting designers, brands that you couldn't find everywhere at a affordable or achievable price point. That was the idea, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Like that's why we call it Market.
Yeah.
We brainstormed for a while trying to find the right name and Market had to be in it. And then we just tried to brainstorm about the girl that we wanted to align with and, you know, that pixie haircut, that like short hair, like a cutesy girl felt like it was the right match, I would say.
I mean, this is amazing because also, again, like nothing like this existed at the time and certainly not in New York. It's so cool that you were so ahead of things because, again, I want to take everyone back. 2006, I remember this era well because that's when we started Who What Wear. The iPhone didn't exist. Vogue didn't have a website and wouldn't for several years. It was a very different time and place. So finding a space, getting the right products there, that is a huge lift all on its own. But how did you get people to come and shop? How did you get the word out? And at what point did you start to feel like there's something actually viable here business-wise?
I mean, it's not like we were interested in money as well. Obviously, the rents were not what they were today and so on, especially in the Lower East Side. I think the lesson here is you just need to follow your passion as well. You need to do things from your heart. It just makes a hell of a difference. First of all, I was in the store and I think my partner was at some point too. But when you're in the store, it's like you telling your story. It just makes a huge difference. Even today, if I could be in my store all the time, I mean, I can start and talk to customers like for hours and like explaining like why you wear this with that. But the thing is, it's when it comes from you, passion obviously comes across. And I think people love that. I think there's a very much a genuine thing. And you see it today on social media. What are the most successful posts? Like they keep saying it. Put things that means it's you and why you're doing it. Don't try to overplan and overthink. So I think it's the same way for this. I think it started and we were behind the counter. We were like able to explain why that model, why this style, why do you need this in your closet? And somehow, you know, it kind of picked up. And the fact that you also offer something that's not available everywhere.
And I remember that you started a website really early on and you were selling through that.
Yeah.
And again, this was not a thing. There were a handful of retailers who were in the online space early. It was not even remotely as common as it is today. And I remember our Who What Wear editor say like, oh my gosh, like they have the perfect images and oh, this product is so amazing and we love the price point. How did the e-commerce aspect and being online help that business grow? And what made you decide to do that again at that moment in time when not everyone was doing it?
Yeah, I guess it was kind of organic because you think ahead. Mm-hmm. You're just like, oh, we did this, but we could do that. You know, we could also do that. And now, okay, yeah, we could do a website. I mean, website, you close the door, but you're still working. You're still making sales. I mean, hello, you got to be crazy to not do it. So that was really the beginning. But remember at the time as well, oh my God, to build a website was like...
such a process.
Oh my God, expensive, but also, so it was like, it was hard work. But at the same time, I think we wanted this to look right. We didn't take the clothes, put them on the hanger and just be like, yeah, that's good. Let's just do it like that. No. It's just like a magazine. What if you would put a magazine and you just put the clothes on the floor and you start taking photos? It's like, ew, I don't want to buy that. So give me envy, make me want, like, give me that girl. Like, do I want to be like her? Make me dream, make me travel with the garment and with pictures.
I mean, it's really smart. And I mean, it's the way everyone does it now. So you were definitely on to something. So the early days are interesting because they're so hard and you're like trying to draw from the skills that you already have. I would imagine that with getting new designers or building a website or whatever it is, the fact that you had that investigative journalism background would be really helpful because you didn't take no for an answer. You would persevere and keep pushing, even if it was difficult. I'm wondering if there are any other skills from that journalism world that really helped you as you started building this new business.
I guess research as well. Mm-hmm. Do your research, try to find what people don't have, try to find what's good and bad with other companies and maybe just learn from that. But you have to be aware. You have to be aware of what you're surrounding, of the high and lows of people who have similar business around you. You just need to be interested as well, because, you know, if you can't just like walk in and decide to open a shop and pretend to just live your life and just have that shop and not being aware of what's going on next to you, that's not possible. If you want to succeed or at least survive, people need to understand a little bit of a storytelling, like what is it that you do and why are you doing it? And I feel like that's also what makes you successful, I would say.
And again, folks didn't talk about brand and storytelling the way they do now when you opened. It's just so interesting that these things that came innately from inside have ended up becoming the way that everyone talks about things these days. You were just telling the story of the designer, of why you picked it, because you were excited about it. And now everyone knows that storytelling and that authenticity is absolutely essential to having any sort of healthy company. And you were just doing it organically, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, but now I have to go back and be like, okay, I forgot to tell other people about the storytelling because I know it, but apparently I have to make a brand book and make sure they understand. So the thing that I would say lack is the business side of things as well. You do things from passion, but at some point you need to bring the business side and the more the corporate vibe, I would say, into your business, because that's one of my problem, I guess, is that I assume people read myself and read everything I mean, which is not the case. So translating this into words, into printing items that people can read and understand is definitely important as well. Like you assume you're outspoken and your door is open, so everything is just transparent, but it takes a little bit more for that when you grow.
Yes. So let's talk about what happened over the next 8 years, and at what point did you decide to start evolving into something new and different?
I got older. Maybe that's what happened.
Yeah, that does change things.
Yeah, I just got older, and in a way it makes complete sense. You cannot sell what you don't believe in, okay? And there was a moment where I wanted a more, I guess, serious, a bit more upscale, a bit more businessy attire, I guess, but without being contrived and like looking really like you were dressing for men or whatever. I was looking for like a uniform or like an everyday outfit that I couldn't find anywhere. I really couldn't. I remember like even checking Zara and stuff. I was like, God, this is so boring. So I wanted something minimal, but elevated. And that's how I felt like I needed to shift a little bit. And so we decided to part away. So I started Frankie after that, based on that simple thing that I just wanted to look a little bit different. I just wanted the woman that I was going to be buying for, I just wanted her to have these looks that I was looking for that I couldn't find. And I felt, if I can find it, I'm a journalist. I can find it. It doesn't exist. We need to make it.
See, this is what I mean. We always talk about this on this podcast, is that the things that we learn in our first lives that you don't think will necessarily apply to a different industry or even the same industry, but just like a different aspect of it, it comes around. It's all so valuable and you're going to use it in different ways. And to your point, the reporter is saying, well, if I can't find it and I want it, I'm sure there are other people who do as well.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I guess I grew up and I wanted to have a bit more of a grown-up customer. And for that, the branding of Frankie was born. And Frankie alone, the name is very much like, you know, androgynous. It was really being a woman that didn't want to play with these codes that were written by somehow men, I think, really. Like just, I just wanted to evolve towards this path. But when we rebranded Frankie into that same store, I remember being like, I'm not doing a website.
What?
I'm like, no way, I'm not doing a website. I don't even want to hear about this. I was like, you know what? I just want to breathe a little and not have pressure. And of course, that stopped after 2 months, probably. Peer pressure, of course. So we started the website. And thank God at that moment, we had so many more tools, so many more easier and cheaper tools to do this, to make this happen. So it was me and someone else. We did it, just the two of us.
Did you have a sense of, okay, like I want this assortment to be like this, or I think these are the right designers? How were you thinking about the curation piece of it for Frankie? And was it different than your previous process?
It was different because the mood board was different.
Yeah.
This was a blank page and this was what I wanted. And I was very sure of myself. I just curate. I'm not a designer per se. I'm a curator. I'm a stylist as well, I guess, because I put things together that I hope will match. But guess what? You're not going to find that many bags on my website, for example. Want to know why? Because I can't figure out what bags are like. And I'm like, you know what? You're just going to go to Chanel or Dior or whatever to get your bag, because right now I'm still working on the bag I want to get. So I'm not pushing products that I don't believe are like relevant, I would say, or at least relevant for the look that I want to propose. And I'm not saying it's a look for everyone. It's definitely my take on that everyday fashion. It's kind of being undone. You know, it's like, think about Kate Moss back in the day. She was the master at this. She would get out the door in like that perfect outfit, but that you were like, how am I going to recreate this? That's perfect, but it looks like it's not, you know? She didn't have heels. She didn't have this. It had that London vibe. It had that New York downtown thing. And then still she was chic and elegant. You got to blend in all these things together and try to make it happen. Not always easy. I'm not saying it's always easy.
I mean, she's Kate Moss for a reason.
And exactly.
On everyone's mood board for a reason. There aren't a million Kate Mosses out there. So yeah, it's definitely a specific skill set. So I'm curious about what it was like the second time around, being able to have sort of a second go at things. Like, you've learned certain lessons through Pixie Market and through your time in the industry. Were there certain things that were easier this time around? At the same time, other aspects of the industry change and evolve. So I'm sure that there were challenges too. But I can't help but think there would be something, even though the concept is different, so satisfying about being able to say, okay, like, let's do this over again. We'll bring the best of what I know from before and mix it with the best of what I think it should be and move forward. But I'm interested in your own actual lived experience.
Right. I mean, it's true that it was obviously easier. The tools, like we said, the tools were easier, first of all. So for that alone, I mean, we launched the website overnight. I didn't sleep the entire night, like wired. And then it was Thanksgiving weekend. And the person I was with was American. So I finally at 4 a.m. was like, just go home to your family in Pennsylvania. Go home. I'll be. I was like in my PJ behind the computer. And yeah, so obviously what was easier is that we launched knowing, obviously, the contacts that you guys helped us. I mean, we had a few articles here and there, and boom, that's it. The first weekend, we were already sold out of a few items, and I was like, oh. So that and another thing that you need to know is Instagram was kind of a new thing as well. It was like the most amazing tool. I mean, it's like I had my own magazine.
Yeah.
For the first time, you can talk about yourself and other people can see it. You can actually describe. Your storytelling is also amazing on pictures. And it kind of grew from there. But what also created some success for us is that for me, being behind and alone, it felt like I was really liberated to also talk about things that really mattered to me. And about social things as well. I don't think you can live a life being completely disconnected with what's going on around you. And when Trump was elected, I remember talking to other women and Planned Parenthood was going to be defunded and stuff. And then we started like we should do a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood. We can bring all this designer, da, 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 da. So I hosted it in like some junk space. It was like wire everywhere in the Lower East Side. It was fantastic, like an old restaurant. And then we had all these designers coming with their things. We reached out to Planned Parenthood who gave us stuff. It was really a great success. We raised like 10K, and doing it for the right thing really felt so good. Yes, it's closing, but closing is a part of who I am and what I want to show the world. Like, what is it? How do I want to show myself in the world? And, you know, I remember always that quote. Actually, somebody posted that quote today, the Miranda quote, you know, like in The Devil Wears Prada, when she says, oh, you think you picked that sweater on your own, da, 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 da. You know?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, she was right somehow. It's like, no. that sweater was picked in this room, blah, 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 blah. My point is that you cannot be separated. Who you are, what you wear is what you want to say to the world as well. And somehow having those, that charity brought it like kind of together. And all of a sudden, my Instagram exploded. I mean, exploded, you know, I probably got like 3,000 followers more and stuff. Not that it mattered, but it kind of felt good, you know? It felt like, you know what? People want to hear that too. People want to feel like that storytelling just through clothes is not enough. And it's not like I'm pushing this speech just because I think it will give me followers. It's actually, I believe in it. I believe, I mean, my journey to where I am today is also a big part was also to listen to people's story and their struggle. And as a journalist, obviously, I had like some terrible stories that came through on my desk and everything. So, and I always known like you cannot be successful on your own, you know, you just kind of have to share and make sure like other people have a voice, at least if you think something is not right. And to that day, I've always like tried to, as much as possible, obviously money-wise, but to try to give back when I could, I would say. So just to that story, I think this is what took Frankie to another level after that event, I would say.
And it's true because this is something that we talk about on Who, What, Where all the time, is that our readers want to vote with their wallet. It's not enough just to be a good t-shirt. Folks are interested in what they're actually supporting when they buy that, whether it's a blazer or a shoe, whatever it is.
Yes.
I also want to talk about the stock aspect. So one of the things that you mentioned is, oh, you know, like we went online and then something sold out immediately. And that's one of the things I've always loved, is that it's not fast fashion in any way, but you feel the need to quickly decide if you want something because you know that it's going to sell out and that might be the last time that you have the opportunity to buy it. It's also a really smart way of testing things from a business point of view. So could you tell me a little bit about how you think about buying things, quantities, how you came upon that strategy? Because I think it's so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really a strategy to begin with, because it was more like, okay, I'm like, I have that much budget, so let me put that much budget there, and then we'll see. Like, you know, it's not like I come from money or I can like just like splurge and da da da. Like, so this kind of aspect of my personal self, I guess, translated into the way I was doing buying, and I've also not learned buying at school. You know, I remember buying a buying book. I was like, when I started, actually, I still have it, I think. And so I tried to teach myself a little, but I was like, okay, well, this is a bit complicated. So I'm just not going to do the math part. I'm going to do the instinct thing part. So The instinct told me, like, you know what? I think this is going to be good. I'm going to buy a little bit more than what I normally do. But still, obviously, it was never enough. And the picture as well took the products to another level. Mm-hmm. So it's just a combination of things that make a product a bestseller. But the strategy was really more, okay, this is the budget that I have. I'm just scared to lose too much money. I'm scared to have a big inventory. So I'm just going to get that for now. And we'll see if people like it. And if people like it, I'll bring it back. And the good thing is, because I produced a lot of stuff in South Korea, is that at least with the units I was doing before, I could get stuff back and like 3 weeks, 4 weeks. The time was not like super wide. Now it's a little bit longer because obviously when I place reorder, it's a lot more. So it takes a little longer to make those clothes, unfortunately. Not as fast as I would like it, but you know, I have to respect the delays, and it's still faster than any other business. And the fact that we are super reactive is a huge, huge asset. And this is definitely what I want to keep. I don't want to spend thousands of money and have all this inventory. And I don't want to become that business when you know that things are going to be on sale like 3 months later. And that, yeah, okay, you had the chance to use that garment for 3 months, but then guess what? It's disposable. Nuh-uh. That's not the way I wanted to see things. So I guess it wasn't a strategy. Now it became a strategy in some ways. I guess the wait list is definitely what I call the wait list, is I have a tool to check how many people wait for something. So based on that, I place order. It's not based on me gauging. I mean, sometimes I don't have a choice. I gauge over. Obviously, if I see that the wait list goes super quickly in one day, I'm gauging in like 3 weeks is going to be like three times this. So obviously I have to gamble a little bit. But in my business, we try to really have timeless pieces. Is I use the word timeless for a reason, because it's a blazer, and that blazer hopefully will carry on. I mean, the boyfriend blazer I've been selling for 5 years. Mm-hmm. The quilted, same thing, you know, and it's never been on sale. So this is why my price point also is hopefully not too high. I mean, I know I'm a little bit higher than before, and that I'd like it to be as well. It's just that everything is more expensive. First of all, the fabric is more.
Yeah.
So I just have to follow this path and make sure that people are being paid the right way. So yeah, it's really the business model. It's making sure people want something, testing things out. You kind of build momentum and it grows. And the fact also that none of these products are available anywhere, except for obviously some designers that are available in other retailers, but this is a very small part of my business. I buy other designers that are available in other businesses because I like them. And yeah. I'm like, you know what? I actually would love to have them at Frankie. And I think they are in alignment with what I'm offering. So it's always been a balance between these kind of design, I would say.
I mean, I have to say, I think it's so smart. A, to be responsive is much better for the environment from a sustainability standpoint, because then you're not sitting on a ton of inventory that you then have to do something with. Like, you're still, to your point, making a gamble. You're guessing that this piece is going to sell through in this way, but it's an informed gamble because you have the waitlist data, because you know how quickly people are interested in something, which is just so smart. So another major milestone for the brand was opening the Paris store. I assume that the markets are a little bit different, maybe not wildly drastically, but that the customer in Paris and the customer in the States can be a little bit different. So I'm curious to how you think through, is the buy the same? Is the styling different? Like, how do those customer differences show up?
I mean, yeah, I guess they are different, but do I care? No. Sorry. I'm just going to do things my way. So yeah, I entered the Paris atmosphere without thinking about it too much in terms of like, oh, I need to buy things different. No, this was Frankie. And you see, this is either you like Frankie or you don't. Yeah. And then we'll close and that's it. Basta. You know, we don't talk about it anymore. And obviously, yes, you want success, but it wasn't a goal. I mean, I just, I had the opportunity to open a store in a friend of mine's space, which he was leaving. So I was like, oh, you know, and then at that time I was trying to have a baby with a French boyfriend. So basically, I just followed basically a man, which is not a good sign, on each side of the pond. So I was like, oh, I could have been in Paris just enjoying my New York business and be fine with it. But of course, I had to create more work for myself and be like, oh, wouldn't that be funny to just start a business in Paris? Yeah, right. So of course, after that, I was pregnant, running a store, like working from above the store and just doing market with my newborn child 1 week later after he was born.
Oh, goodness.
So yeah, it's been like a journey, but the Paris store was very much a moment. And frankly, the buying was exactly the same. At first, it wasn't really Parisian anyway coming, or French. The difference between French and American is the French are very difficult to reach out, or they need to understand who you are, what you do. You know, I love America for this. It's just like, if they love something, they're just going to go for it. For a French person, they're never going to buy right away unless it's a fashionista. And to me, at the beginning, the Frankie in Paris was living through the customers that we had from New York, obviously, the aura that we had from there, and the foreigners that knew about it. Like during Fashion Week, it was like right away, like people were coming. They knew it was like a little bit of a secret. Mm-hmm. And that street where I am, Rue Saint-Claude, was like really dead. Like there was nothing. Like I was like, oh my God, if we get customer, we'll be lucky. But it picked up. Like all of a sudden, we started like having articles in like some French newspaper, and the French came. And I remember when Paris store started making more than the New York store, and I was like, whoa. Okay. So it was kind of a proud moment, because New York was so busy that it was obviously nice to see that we were able to also translate this in France, in the capital of fashion. You know, Paris is very, very, very much connected to the fashion business.
So when you think about Frankie and the future, and what you want to do next, what is sort of at the top of that list? What are you thinking about?
It's complicated. It's complicated because the thing is, I'd like to remain really a niche brand. I don't want to be everywhere because it's just, I feel like if you overflow the market, your message starts getting diluted and stuff. So to all the small stores that want to carry us, I am sorry that I cannot do that, unfortunately. And not only that, I still don't have the production capacity to make it happen. So I'm working on trying to fix this, also produce closer to destination to avoid all these like planes and just be a little bit more reasonable with my carbon print. So that's like really my goal, is definitely like the production location, part of our production being closer to where we are. And so for the US, it would be like in LA or in New Jersey, you know, and for Europe, it would be Portugal, Turkey, all these places that have fantastic production facilities. But then at the same time, I cannot lose my turnaround and it needs to be on a fast pace. So yeah, I would say I remain a niche brand with global relevance. Is that possible to say that?
I love that. Yes.
It's part of my new brand book. I'm so proud of that sentence.
That's a really good sentence. It sounds like a contradiction, but it's not.
Exactly. It's kind of contradictory at the same time. And it's really where I would like to be. I mean, I can't tell you, maybe in 2 years, I will have a different speech about where I want my company to be based on where I am in my personal life, probably at that time, like it's possible. But as of now, my goal is to just structure, make sure I have the right people working for us, make sure that things are easier as well for everyone. Everyone that has been working for me has been working hard. And I'd like things to be a little bit easier, even on myself, to be honest with you. It's been a long ride, a fantastic ride, though, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm really happy and I hope I can fuel the people that work with me with the same kind of energy that having people wanting to wear your pieces gives you, because that's really what it is. And I love going to the store for that. I was in the store today and you can hear people have questions and sometimes, you know, so Frankie, I guess in the next year, hopefully we'll go to certain cities where I feel is a right move for us. Like London, for example, is really a city that I want to go to, that I think I need to go to as well because of the Brexit. It's very difficult for our customers to shop on our website. So I would like to bring it back to them in an easier way. And then I don't know, there's a few places. I think America is definitely also one of my focus now that Paris it's running. So New York, we renovated the Lower East Side store, took over the store next door. So that's going to be one bigger store. And I'm keeping, when I was closed, I opened a pop-up on Crosby. I'm keeping that as well. So second location in New York. And then I'm thinking LA could be a good idea. What do you guys think?
I think that's a great idea. I think we would love that.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely a town that loves us and we would love to open something there for sure.
Let me know. We'll help in any way
we
can.
Yes, I will.
So we talk about mistakes on this podcast a lot because everyone makes mistakes, but we don't always like talking about it. So I'm wondering if you can tell me about a mistake that you've made at any point in your career and what you've learned from it.
I don't like looking at things like mistake because you learn from everything.
Yes.
I always use like that movie Sliding Door as a reference. It's like a
good, yes!
You know what? You took that route and like this is what happened. And like
different
if
life.
You had taken the, yes, but guess what? You go where your guts tell you. And yes, of course, looking back, I would do things differently for certain things. Like I said, even the Paris store, the way I open, everything is very quickly with me. So I also need to just like calm down and also learn to leave the process. So I feel like maybe my advice is don't try to rush things and try to also think a little bit more. Maybe when you do things with maybe a more like poised brain and less eager of momentum of missing out, like FOMO, whatever that is, then maybe you just you can do this even better than what I did. That's for sure.
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are in their first life and they want to do something different but haven't done it yet and are nervous. What advice would you give them?
I mean, I would say follow your guts. And this one thing that COVID, maybe positive, I guess, thing that COVID gave us is to just realize that there was other things maybe than just having a career and being stuck in this business, because you need like at least 10 more years in this path and just going to have a heart attack at the end of it because you like so stressed. So yeah, the lesson is follow your guts, but also really do your homework. Mm-hmm. Follow what you want to do, but also remember that you're going to have to show up for it.
Last question is my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with your younger self at any point in your career and give your younger self some advice, what would you say?
Oh, God.
And would she listen?
Well, exactly. I don't think she would, because she doesn't have time to listen. She's already moved on from what everything you said and forgot it. I guess that would be it then. That would be like, just try to learn a little bit more. Try to be a bit more thorough about the certain things. Try to stop thinking that if you don't do things right away, everything will fall apart. Being a bit more gentle on yourself as well. I've always been a bit like tough. I also would have spent more time with my family. I think at the same time in your first life, you tend to just focus on yourself and not realizing that those people are what made you, you know, you are who you are today, thanks to them. And being a part of their life to me is very important. So family should be a support system and you should not ignore that and try to really acknowledge it. But yeah, I guess that's what I would do.
It's great advice. And this was perfect. Thank you so much. As someone who has followed your career for many, many years, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this.
Thank you.
That was the founder of the Frankie Shop, Gael Dravé. For more inspiring interviews with women like Gael, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you're interested in hearing from on the show. So send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life. Walkhole bras are loved across generations because superior fit and quality are for all women. When you look and feel your best, you'll have the confidence to take on your day with conviction. It's never been easier to find the right bras. Head to walkhole-america.com to learn more about bra fit and get personalized style recommendations. That's WAKHOLE-america.com.